And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, just to give you an update on how Sam has responded to my wife being attacked in their store. Still silence. I guess they figure if they don't say anything, we'll get tired and go away. Not going to happen. Today's March 26th. She was attacked February 21st at 10 in the morning. But once again, March 26th, the 85th day of the year. 280 days remain until this year is over with. In the year 590 AD, Emperor Maurice proclaims his son Theodosius as co-emperor of the Byzantine Empire, which was originally known as the Eastern Roman Empire. 1027, Pope John the 19th crowns Conrad II as Holy Roman Emperor. 1169, Saladin becomes the Emir of Egypt. 1344, the Siege of Algeciras, one of the first European military engagements where gunpowder was used. It came to an end on this date. 1351, Combat of the 30. 30 Breton knights call out and defeat 30 English knights. 1484, William Caxton prints his translations of Aesop Fables. 1552, Guru Amar Das becomes the third Sikh guru. 1636, Utrecht University is founded in the Netherlands. 1651, silver-loaded Spanish ship San Jose is pushed south by strong winds, wrecks on the coast of southern Chile, and its surviving crew is killed by indigenous Kunkos. And all that silver vanished into the sands. 1696, Safavid government troops take control of Basra. 1812, an earthquake devastates Caracas, Venezuela. 1812, a political cartoon in the Boston Gazette coins the term gerrymander to describe oddly shaped electoral districts designed to help incumbents win re-election. 1830, Book of Mormon is published in Palmyra, New York. Joseph Smith was the originator. Supposedly, the Book of Mormon was translated from a number of golden tablets revealed to Smith by an angel by the name of Moroni. 1839, the first Henley Royal Regatta is held. 1871, the elections of Commune Council of the Paris Commune are held. 1885, the Métis people of the District of Saskatchewan under Louis Riel began the Northwest Rebellion against Canada. 1896, the explosion of the Brenner Mine near Greymouth in New Zealand killed 65 coal miners in the country's worst industrial accident. 1913, in the First Balkan War, Bulgarian forces capture Adrianople. 1915, the Vancouver Millionaires win the 1915 Stanley Cup Finals, the first championship played between the Pacific Coast Hockey Association and the National Hockey Association. 1917, World War I, First Battle of Gaza. British troops are halted after 17,000 Turks block their advance. 1922, the German Social Democratic Party is founded in Poland. Great place for a German political party to be founded. 1931, Swiss Air is founded as the national airline of Switzerland. 1931, the Ho Chi Minh Communist Youth Union is founded in Vietnam. 1934, the United Kingdom driving test is introduced. 1939, Spanish Civil War. The Nationalists began their final offensive of the war. 1942, the first female prisoners arrived at Auschwitz concentration camp in German-occupied Poland. 1945, World War II, the Battle of Iwo Jima ends as the island is officially secured by American forces. 1954, nuclear weapons testing. The Romeo shot of Operation Castle was detonated at Bikini Atoll and yielded 11 megatons. I think the one that destroyed Nagasaki was 3 megatons. 1958, U.S. Army launches Explorer 3. 1958, the African Regroupment Parties launched at a meeting in Paris. 1967, 10,000 people gather for one of the many Central Park be-ins in New York City. That was back in the days of free love, don't you know? 1970, South Vietnamese President Nguyen Van Thieu implements a land reform program to solve the problem of land tenancy. 1971, East Pakistan declares its independence from Pakistan to form Bangladesh, and the Bangladesh Liberation War begins. 1975, the Biological Weapons Convention comes into play. 1979, Anwar al-Sadat, Menachem Begin, and Jimmy Carter signed the Egypt-Israel Peace Treaty in Washington, D.C. They preempted Battlestar Galactica, which was my favorite program at the time, and they showed it ad nauseum on the networks. 1981, Social Democratic Party in the UK is founded as a party. 1982, a groundbreaking ceremony for the Vietnamese Veterans Memorial is held in Washington, D.C. 1991, on this date, Argentina, Brazil, Uruguay, and Paraguay signed the Treaty of Asunción, established in Mercosur, the South Common Market. 1997, 39 bodies are found in the Heaven's Gate mass suicides. They believed that in the tail of the Hale-Bopp comet was a big UFO that was going to take them all to a better world. But they had to commit suicide in order to do it. 1998, during the Algerian Civil War, the Oued Bouaché massacre sees 52 people, mostly infants, killed with axes and knives. 2005, about 200,000 to 300,000 Taiwanese demonstrate in Taipei in opposition to the anti-secession law of China. 2010, the South Korean Navy corvette Cheonan is torpedoed, kills 46 sailors. After an international investigation, the President of the United Nations Security Council blames North Korea, which was a first for the UN to blame anybody other than the United States. 2017, Russia-wide anti-corruption protest in 99 cities. The Levada City survey showed that 38% of surveyed Russians supported the protest and 67% held Putin personally responsible for high-level corruption. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day. Castulus, Emmanuel and Companions. Felicitas. Harriet Monsell in the Church of England, Larissa Ludger, Richard Allen in the Episcopal Church in the U.S., Independence Day and National Day in Bangladesh, celebrates their independence from Pakistan in 1971, Martyrs Day or Day of Democracy in Mali, Prince Kulo Day in Hawaii, Purple Day in Canada and the U.S., and Synaxis of the Archangel Gabriel on this date. Okay, well, in 1812, on this date, an earthquake measuring 7.7 on the Richter scale destroyed 90% of Caracas, Venezuela, and killed between 15 and 20,000 people. 1871, municipal elections that may or may not have been similar to the ones we just had bring revolutionaries to power in Paris to form the commune government. 1909, in support of Muhammad Ali Shah's coup d'etat against the constitutional government in Persia, Russian military force invades northern Persia to relieve the siege of Tabriz. 1942, the first Eichmann transport takes people to Auschwitz and Birkenau concentration camps. Adolf Eichmann was the man in charge of implementing the, what was called the final solution. So these were called Eichmann transports. 1953, Dr. Jonas Salk announces he successfully tested a vaccine to prevent polio. They're going to begin clinical trials in 1954. 1966, large-scale anti-Vietnam War protests take place in the U.S. Major protests in New York, Washington, D.C., and Chicago. 1971, Bangladesh, or as East Pakistan, as I said before, under Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, declares its independence from Pakistan. 26th, 1845, a patent was awarded for an adhesive medicated plaster, which was the lead into the Band-Aid. This is also William Westmoreland's birthday and Leonard Nimoy's birthday. Both of them are dead. And it's also Pelosi's birthday, the woman who would be king. She's 81, and she says, anyone who is over the age of 65 is a drain on society. She's 81. And since her main occupation has been in Congress, she's worth over $100 million. Now ask yourself how she got that. In 127 A.D., Greek astronomer and mathematician Ptolemy begins his observations of the heavens. 685, Cuthbert, who went on to become St. Cuthbert, is consecrated Bishop of Lindisfarne by Archbishop Theodore at York. 1147 A.D., Jewish community in Cologne fast to commemorate anti-Jewish violence. On this day in 1526, King Francis I returns from Spanish captivity. He comes back to France and resumes his rule. 1534, Lübeck accepts free Dutch ships into the East Sea. 1668, England takes control of Bombay, India. 1692, King Maximilian installed his land guardian of South Netherlands. 1780, the first British Sunday newspaper hits the streets. It's the British Gazette and Sunday Monitor. What if they had a cartoon section? 1790, Congress passes the Naturalization Act, which requires a 2-year residency. 1799, Napoleon captures Jaffa in Palestine. 1804, Congress orders the removal of all Indians east of the Mississippi. They're to be taken to Louisiana. Also in 1804, the Territory of Orleans organizes in the Louisiana Purchase. 1808, Charles IV of Spain abdicates in favor of his son, Ferdinand VII. According to Mormon scholars, in 1820, future Mormon church leader Joseph Smith has his first vision in a wooded area of New York. In 1845, Joseph Francis from New York City patents a corrugated sheet iron lifeboat. 1859, there was the first sighting of what was called Vulcan, a planet thought to orbit inside Mercury, between Mercury and the Sun. Scientists, of course, assure us there is no such thing. 1862, the Battle of La Glorieta Pass in New Mexico Territory. It was an Apache Canyon at Pigeon's Ranch. 1863, voters in West Virginia approved the gradual emancipation of slaves. 1872, a 7.8 magnitude earthquake shakes Owens Valley, California. 1872, Thomas J. Martin of Alabama gets a patent for a pipe and valve fire extinguisher system. 1878, Hastings College of Law is founded in California. 1885, the Eastman Film Company manufactures its first commercial motion picture film. 1885, Louis Riel, a politician and revolutionary, his forces defeat the Canadian forces at Duck Lake in Saskatchewan. In 1885, the first cremation is held in England. 1895, King Alfonso plants pine saplings in Madrid, and that starts Spain's Arbor Day. 1903, the American Hotel opens in Amsterdam. 1910, the U.S. forbids immigration to criminals, anarchists, paupers, and the sick. 1910, William Lewis appointed U.S. Assistant Attorney General. 1913, Bulgaria captures Adrianople and is the first Balkan War. 1913, Dayton, Ohio is almost destroyed when the Scioto, the Miami, and the Muskingum River reaches flood stage simultaneously. 1926, the first lip reading tournament is held in America. Now that's a game you gotta watch. 1927, the Gaumont British Film Corporation is formed. 1930, Congress appropriates $50,000 to build the Inter-American Highway. That's the one I think that goes from the tip of Argentina all the way to Alaska. 1935, R.J. Mitchell and Major Sorley discuss armament of Supermarine Spitfire. 1937, William Hastie becomes the first black federal judge, and that was in the Virgin Islands. 1942, on this date, the German offensive in North Africa began under General Erwin Rommel. Had lunatic Hitler not forced Rommel to commit suicide, Rommel might have won the day for the Germans. 1943, the Battle of Komondorski Islands between the American Navy and the Japanese Navy in the Pacific ended inconclusively. 1945, on this date, the Allies, led by U.S. Marine Corps, secure the island of Iwo Jima. And it was on this date that the flag was originally raised. 1945, Allied Generals Dwight D. Eisenhower, Omar Bradley, and George Patton launch an attack at Remagen on the Rhine. That gave rise to the book and the movie One Bridge Too Far. 1945, on this date, a kamikaze attack took place on the U.S. battle fleet near Kurama Reto. 1945, the U.S. 7th Army crosses the Rhine at Worms. 1951, U.S. Air Force flags officially adopted by President Truman. 1955, the Ballad of Davy Crockett, the version recorded by Hill Hayes, becomes the number one record in the U.S. 'We've come to the end of our history segment for not only today, but for the week. And we are going to talk about a little bit more information from the Wild, Wild West. Well, sometimes your reputation is a detriment. George Armstrong Custer and his wife Elizabeth Custer made a handsome pair. They were the Camelot couple of the 1800s before John and Jackie Kennedy. Both were keen on public relations and appearances, and they would each go on to write books about the West. Now, their love and ardor for each other has been well documented over the decades, but when it came to describing the ideal American physical specimen, they each independently agreed that could only be bestowed on a man who'd already established just such a reputation throughout the plains long before he'd served as the Indian Scout. When Custer wrote his 1874 book, My Life on the Plains, he described Wild Bill Hickok in this manner. He said, whether on foot or on horseback, he's one of the most perfect types of physical manhood I ever saw. Of his courage, there could be no question. His skill in the use of the rifle and the pistol was unerring. His deportment was entirely free of all bluster and bravado. And he never spoke about himself unless he was requested to do so. And his conversation never bordered on the vulgar or the blasphemous. His influence among the frontiersmen was unbounded. His word was law. Well, for her part, Libby Custer, in her book, Following the Guide On, went into more unusual detail about Hickok. In fact, what she said bordered on the blissfully indiscreet. She said, physically, he was a delight to look on. Tall, lithe, free in every motion, he rode and walked as if every muscle was perfection. And the careless swing of his body as he moved seemed perfectly in keeping with the man. I don't recall anything finer in the way of physical perfection than Wild Bill when he swung himself from his saddle. So how does someone live up to all this? By the time the Custers paid such glowing tribute to the scout, he'd already received the kind of press that made him the first real law and exacting legend of the era. In fact, he was admired and feared throughout the country for exploits that seemed impossible to reconcile. He's supposed to have killed hundreds of men, marched with a shy demeanor and a sweet humility, despite an almost Beatles-like obsession from the local ladies. So it was the fate of Wild Bill, who could never walk down any street without wondering who might be behind him with a gun. He may have been the architect and agent of his own brand, with one bear fight, a couple of gunfights, and the most famous magazine article of the day describing him. But by doing so, he also, in a sense, wrote his own epitaph and a cautionary tale that would follow him to a grisly death. According to Richard White, professor emeritus of American history at Stanford, there are these figures with outsized reputations who are on both sides of the law and During this period, people were writing these romantic tales while they were actually happening. And a classic figure here is Wild Bill Hickok, who becomes in some ways a prisoner of his own myth. Now, despite an incorrect spelling, the William Hitchcock, written about by George Ward Nichols in Harper's New Monthly magazine in 1867, appeared to emerge fully formed to an unsuspecting public unprepared for this magnet of adventure. At the time, Harper's held sway among the most popular magazines of the day, and the frustrated, big-dreaming Easterner set up every claim Wild Bill made in the story. Hickok came across as a jauntily dressed man and willing to bow to indiscretions. And while taciturn, he let his colts do most of his talking. Now, much of that fuss about his abilities came from a day in 1865. It was July 21st, to be exact. There was a quick-draw duel that Hickok had with Davis Tutt. And this event was regarded as the first of its kind in the Wild West. Now, Hickok had come to Springfield, Missouri as just another gambler, but the disagreements with Tutt rose over money and goods won and lost, specifically Tutt's grabbing Hickok's beloved pocket watch and calling it collateral for debts owed. The in-your-face disagreement between the men would end days later at a distance of about 75 yards. Each man fired a single shot at the other, and while Tutt missed his target, Hickok's bullet landed right on the money. Tutt yelled to his friends, "Boys, I'm killed," before he collapsed. In fact, he staggered off to die while Hickok kept his gun up to keep the friends at bay. And those same friends were appalled when a jury eventually acquitted Wild Bill. But George Ward Nichols, reading the accounts, made his way to Springfield to hear the full tale from what he later described as Bill's thin and sensitive lips. 2 years later, Nichols' tale thrilled a nation when it was published. He wrote, "You wouldn't believe that you were looking into eyes that have pointed the way to death to hundreds of men. It's Wild Bill with his own hand has killed hundreds of men, of that I've no doubt. He shoots to kill, as they say," insisted on reporting such number to Nichols, having grown up reading dime novels covering heroic exploits and fashioning himself in that image. And after that, the readers couldn't get enough. It wasn't just the dime novels Hickok was discussed in, but also Harper's magazine and articles, and Harper's had the power to create those sort of Western icons. And so it happens to so many of these figures, they adopt the role that people describe for them. They create a persona, and then they inhabit their own persona. The only issue was, like highly charged icons of any other era, Bill's path now seemed preordained to be spectacular. And for that reason, the fall was almost inevitable. First, he rode the wave he churned up for himself. He served successfully as a scout during the Indian Wars after the Civil War. And this was when Hickok wasn't busy trying to work up an outdoor show that failed in his attempt to inspire a lazy buffalo with a gunshot in the air and led the animal to trample through the audience. Became a deputy U.S. Marshal and was elected city marshal of Hays, Kansas in 1867, as well as local county sheriff. Now, these posts he excelled in through fear and action. On at least two occasions, he was confronted by men who'd come to town looking to take him on, threatening the locals and trying to achieve their own fame. In each case, Hickok's ambidextrous prowess proved too much for him. Some clean, fatal shots to the head from a distance brought a sense of order and intimidation. His reputation for gun mastery was fated to outlive him, placing Hickok on the short list of the best of the Western. Then he brought his act to the cranky town of Abilene, Kansas, becoming marshal after the killing of his predecessor, Tom Bear River Smith. He earned the admiration of unparalleled outlaw John Wesley Hardin, but the ire of Hardin's saloon-owning pal, Phil Coe,
Coe's confrontation to Hickok would spell the beginning of the end for Wild Bill. The pair repeatedly traded what became the most renowned set of threats in the Old West, with Coe gunning for Hickok and telling him he once shot a crow in the wing. And Hickok responded, "Did that crow have a pistol? Was he shooting back? I will be." Well, Coe failed to heed that counsel, and October 5th, 1871, he came at the sheriff and began shooting. Unfortunately, he missed. Hickok shot him twice. Coe died the next day, but then, catching a glimpse of somebody running his way, Hickok fired again, thinking it was an ally of Coe's. It was, in fact, Hickok's own deputy marshal, Mike Williams, who'd been coming to his aid. That killing haunted Hickok, and 2 months later, on the strength of this incident and a few others, he was relieved of duty. In the final 5 years of his life, Hickok remained an intimidating presence, but he also found himself on a slow and painful descent. His drinking and gambling both increased, and he suffered maybe the cruelest blow to a man of his skills. The loss of clear vision ultimately attributed to glaucoma and some other issues. And as a marked man, he'd have to be wily to avoid conflict, but he grew less and less careful. Brief stop working on his friend Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West show ended up being nearly disastrous. Cody tried to incorporate him into the stage shows, and unfortunately Hickok was incorrigible. Very often he would be drunk, and while his gun is supposed to be loaded with blanks, he'd accidentally use real bullets. He terrified the rest of the cast, and Cody had to let him go. By then, he had slipped totally out of control. And that he died the way he did is no mystery. On August 2nd, 1876, the once formidable lawman was seated at the poker table at the Nuttall and Mann Saloon in the Dakota town of Deadwood. While his radar for trouble was always fine-tuned, a mix of neglect and ego found him forgetting his usual seat, which was facing the door. With Hickok's back exposed, Jack McCall, an itinerant gambler who tussled with Bill the day before over some perceived insult, walked up behind him and, having had a few drinks of his own, took out his gun and with a cry of, "Take that, damn you," he put a single fatal bullet in the back of Hickok's head. Take a couple of trials over the 7 month period for McCall to hang for the crime. But it would take all of 2 seconds for Hickok to begin growing from once feared lawman to timeless legend. According to many of the things he claimed to have done, he actually did. Although the gap between many and all is as wide as the expanse of the plains, you might say. But for men who jealously wanted to notch his killings on their belt, that was enough. The sight of Hickok alone inspired envy. As Nichols had written in Harper's, a deerskin shirt, or frock it might be called, hung over his shoulders, and revealed a chest whose breadth and depth were remarkable. Those lungs that had grown in some 20 years of the free air of the Rocky Mountains, his small waist was girded by a belt that held two of Colt's Navy revolvers. History might point to McCall as the instrument of Hickok's death, but he was only the last in a long line of those who tried. And had Hickok not been sitting with his back to the door, he probably wouldn't have been able to achieve it. Hickok was known for sitting in what he called the gunfighter seat, which was with his back to the wall. On this particular day, he was, shall we say, feeling no pain when he sat down for that game. Well, Wild Bill Hickok's biggest competition for the West top spot as the surest shot was that dead-aim darling of the West, Annie Oakley. Now, Buffalo Bill Cody's Wild West shows were thrilling affairs where hundreds of cowboys and Indians worked through reenactments of classic Old West moments almost as if they were happening again. But even with all the action and amazement, it was a good bet that most of the 15,000 fans that came for each performance came mainly to see one person. A diminutive 100-pound pretty-as-a-picture lady with a powerful rifle and the means to use it. She was known as America's Sweetheart. While Bill had one rival for the title of surest shot in the plains, it was Annie Oakley. Little Missy, as Cody called her, was a shy farm girl, became a superb shootist, and featured attraction in his shows, according to historian Richard Udalane in Beyond the Missouri. Although modest in dress and never unfeminine in her actions, she nonetheless represented a West that called for competition and courage as necessary for success. She exuded both of those qualities, and while fashioning marksman skills that saw her routinely splitting a playing card through its edge at 30 paces and hitting dimes tossed into the air and cigarettes out of her husband's lips and putting out candles with the whiz of her bullets. After losing her father when she was 6, by 8 she was helping to support her family. She was working for a Cincinnati hotel, killing and providing game for their food supply. No skills that also earn her enough money to pay off her mother's mortgage. Now, Hickok's legendary quick-draw killing of Davis Tutts, understandably famous, but in the annals of the West, it may well be outdone by the tale of the shooting match the Cincinnati hotel sponsored, pitting Annie Oakley, then a 15-year-old, against Frank Butler, one of the greatest marksmen of the day. The pair was evenly matched through some 25 shots. By the end, the young woman won the day. But Butler wasn't embarrassed, as you might think he would be. He was actually smitten. He wooed that young lady, and they married. And they stayed married for close to 50 years. During that time, the pair toured the world as Oakley gained household name status. It was in Cody's show she met and mightily impressed the great chief Sitting Bull, who'd briefly appeared. The two became friends, with the admiring chief calling her Watanya Chichilla, or Little Sure Shot. It was an apt description for the First Lady of Firearms and an inspiration for the runaway hit, Annie Get Your Gun. Well, she once said, aim at the high mark and you'll hit it. No, not the first time, not the second time, maybe not the third time, but keep on aiming and keep on shooting, for only practice will make you perfect. And finally, you will hit the bullseye of success. Well, she certainly did that. And to carry on a 50-year marriage. Well, you know, the U.S. Marshals had quite a reputation in the Old West. There was tales of heroics, death-defying feats, and no shortage of controversy. And I know today the vaunted Texas Rangers have sunk to the level of taking bribes to cover up fraud. In 1937, when he was 80 years old, Orrington Red Lucas sat for an interview. He talked about his 20 years as a deputy U.S. Marshal from 1882 to 1902 in and around Oklahoma. At the age of 24, he was appointed by Hanging Judge Isaac Parker. Well, he was midway through his career when his friend Bob Dalton asked him if he'd be willing to give up the job and join him and his brothers on the Scout, which is what they called a life of crime. Of the Daltons, Lucas recalled to journalist Effie Jackson, there were four of them, as fine of fellows that I'd ever met. There was Bob, Emmett, Grant, and Bill. Bob worked with me as a marshal back in 1889, helping to keep order in Guthrie, Oklahoma. He was a good officer and a dead shot. That's one man I never wanted to aim at me. So when Bob asked me if I wanted to join him, I refused and tried to argue the law and order side of life. But unfortunately, he failed. They said they were leaving that night. When Lucas alerted Bob's mother of the plan, she sent her son-in-law with $500 for each son, if they would stay straight. They refused. They were told to take the money back to mother. She needs it more than we do. We'll get by. Lucas said he cried like a baby. I had intuition and could almost hear the shots that later killed all but one of them. Story about the birth of the Dalton Gang, steeped as it is in Wild West lore, offers one side of the complicated view of the Marshals, who, like their fellows in the Texas Rangers, are government-appointed protectors of the plains. In stories that became staples of dime novels and newspaper tales, they were lauded for dogged pursuit and heroism by bringing feared outlaws to justice. Wyatt Earp, Wild Bill Hickok, Dallas Stoudemire, each counted themselves among them at various times. But in a number of stories, they were also ridiculed for supposed cowardice, criticized for chasing some criminals who'd earned fame for their prowess, and looked upon, down upon for being mercenaries who could sometimes be more dangerous than the outlaws themselves. The notion that Dalton would leave marshalling and move on to violent crime speaks to the complicated reputation of the post. Truth of that reputation remains somewhat in flux, but the marshals and the rangers, many of whom chose the life of the power, allowed an excuse to carry a gun, collect fees from locals. Others saw the West as a place where growth was right around the corner if towns could just clean up their act with themselves as brave agents willing to help pave the way. When Hollywood came along and elevated the Western lawman to hero status, the feds secured their spots of honor, despite what the truth may have been. There have always been two sides of it, according to Richard White, professor emeritus of American history at Stanford. There's the Dalton Gang and the James Gang, and the hatred of marshals and the hatred of rangers could always come because of this sort of official violence that they perpetrated. So even as the people are glorified, there's always been this other set of stories that actually demonize them. In their role as officers, the Texas Rangers go back to the early prairie days. Established in 1823, they were given jurisdiction in the pre-state territory as keepers of the peace along the border with Mexico. They got $15 a month each in land, not money. And as detectives, protectors, and defenders of everything from land deals to cattle industry beefs. Rangers eventually stopped bank robber Sam Bass in his tracks, brought notorious killer John Wesley Hardin in for trial and sentencing, and stopped an assassination attempt on President Taft deeper into the 20th century. Famed Ranger Frank Hammer put Bonnie and Clyde's reign of terror to rest in a hail of bullets. U.S. Marshals came into being with the founding of the nation and a dicey proposition of whether states or the federal government had jurisdiction over law enforcement. Marshals were then assigned by George Washington as arms of the court to collect taxes, take the census, and serve subpoenas. That practice started in 1789. But this oldest federal law enforcement agency also pursued counterfeiters until the creation of the Secret Service in 1865. Worked alongside state militias to establish order. The agency that boasts the motto Justice, Integrity, and Service was also busy with border patrolling and fugitive slave capturing before basically taking their guns to town during the glory days of the Wild West. They kept structure and peace in burgeoning boom towns that had little or none. They were particularly effective in the desperate acres of Indian territory, natural hiding place for outlaws, and their number included such people as the Earp brothers, Bat Masterson, Heck Thomas, and Bass Reeves. But their usefulness suffered with the 1908 forming of the organization that would evolve into the FBI. During their Wild West days, both groups were ultimately trusted as maintainers of order and regarded with suspicion by many locals who saw them as extensions of growing industries. Texas Rangers and Marshals were doing work in the interest of the people in power, and I firmly agree with that, according to John Finley, a professor of history at the University of Washington. And in the Rangers' case, often they were there to keep the Mexicans down, especially in South Texas, to make sure they're prevented from building. I don't agree with that as much as I do with the fact that their hand is out. And they firmly believe in the golden rule, he who has the goal makes the rules. I've seen that in action. Controversies aside, the groups initiated and continued a sordid history that captivates a nation obsessed with law and order heroes. For the Marshals, that standing has a great deal to do with their most notable assignment. The enormous expanse known as Indian Territory that stretched 70,000 square miles These days, it makes up a majority of the state of Oklahoma. Back in the mid-19th century, it was the lawless escape hatch for white criminals eluding the authorities between robberies. And it was here that Judge Parker set the tone for a stricter kind of justice, sending posses of marshals into the brush in search of gangs that terrorized the travelers and bankers in several states. But with disturbing frequency, U.S. marshals were embroiled in charges of fraud and embezzlement. But in spite of that, they enjoyed a romantic aura. Such pursuits, of course, took time and money. Marshals are often after the most notorious names for years. U.S. Marshals Service website has a link devoted to how much did it cost to find Billy the Kid. Now, I might point out that evidence came to light when the records of San Elizario were opened up that Billy the Kid wasn't killed by Pat Garrett. Garrett actually helped him escape. And they also talk about chases to put a big crimp in any robber's ability to make moves at will. And even if both Billy, Jesse James and Billy the Kid were killed by bullets, not fired by marshals, the lawmen deserved a load of credit for keeping the reign of terror contained. Despite their successes, they faced their share of ridicule. A great deal of the most prominent marshals are political appointees, and often their hired deputies are given the plum assignments because of connections. It was the marshals with true detective experience arose to greater prominence. Names such as Reeves and Thomas rang out during their lifetimes. And the marshals killed in between 1872 and 1896 were duly honored. There were more of those you might think. There were 103 during that time period that were killed in Indian Territory. About a quarter of those killed throughout the history of the agency. And yet it was hard for the officers to escape the scorn of their unsalaried role as tax collector. Deputies originally earned their living through fees for specific legal services, payment of expenses, and infrequent rewards, according to Frank Pressell in the Reader's Encyclopedia of the American West. And the fees were paid by those who filed suit. A great many deputies obtained supplemental income from other jobs. Some worked as stage guards, and others ran saloons. Any case of view that's now squelched by the Hollywood memory of Tamara Lee Jones and the Fugitive, whose relentless search of Dr. Richard Kimball turned out to be a pursuit of justice. In reality, the only reason Richard Kimball, or Sam Shepard as his real name was prosecuted was because a newspaper editor hated him and wanted him prosecuted. So, of course, law enforcement fell in line and did what they were told to do. For the Rangers, whose whole charter at the start was to protect the Texas Territory from Indians and Mexicans, the reputation of their own lawful entitlement can best be summed up by a quote from Leander McNally, who made captain of a special force of Rangers in 1875. He said, "No man in the wrong can stand up against a fellow that's in the right and keeps on a-coming." Well, the problem is, it doesn't make any difference these days if it's right or wrong. Whoever's got the money, the Rangers are right there to help them. That said, one man's persistence of purpose is another man's overzealous misuse of power. The image of the Ranger for many is the posse that spent months trailing Sam Bass, whose gangs netted $60,000. That's about $1.5 million today. In the Union Pacific Big Springs robbery, even though, according to Joe Franz in the Reader's Encyclopedia of the American West, the Rangers have often been criticized preferring law and order to justice. And that is a very valid statement. Of course, time and pop culture continue to reshape the perception of both the Marshals and the Rangers, despite the inconvenient limits of reality. There was a tale that was once told of six Texas Rangers ambushed by outlaws and left for dead. All were killed but one, and he was discovered by a native on horseback who recognized the Ranger as, inconceivably enough, a playmate from his childhood days. When nursed back to health, the Ranger and his Indian friend joined forces and vowed to take on bad men throughout the territory. Now, this Lone Ranger's name was rarely spoken, but with his friend Tonto by his side, this daring and resourceful masked rider of the plains led the fight for law and order in the early West. I guess you could say the Lone Ranger single-handedly retooled the reputation of Texas Rangers for a generation faster than you could say, "Hi-ho, Silver!"
And truth is often eclipsed by Hollywood fiction. Well, many people talk about how the West was won, but how did the rest grow up? The people who were drawn to the prairie by the call of the wild, but, well, you know, it couldn't remain untamed forever. In fact, the 1869 Golden Spike Ceremony in Utah brought together the Transcontinental Railroad, and that railroad truly put the West on track to evolve. You know, it was the dime novels that originally brought folks out west. A view from the urban jungles in the east suggested the entire territory as a land of pure, unexplored prairies, with heroes helping the homesteaders make their way in the world. And I wish that was true. It was a place of wild animals you never see otherwise, Indians doing battle against cowboys in newly minted towns where the liquor flowed as easily as the laughs. And beyond all that, there was the gold. Rivers of it. No wonder people picked up stakes and headed out to a land of imagination, options, and adventures, rather than the dirty reality that they lived in. What those dime novels didn't really let folks in on, and what the newspaper stories and ads didn't stress, was that a different tidal wave of immigration had also found its way into that country. It was a wave of industry. And for every attempt to keep the West wild, or prospectors and explorers breaking their backs to make a few bucks, there were an increasing number of bankrollers trying to take charge. Now, it's true that sheriffs and marshals did their best to tame the local skirmishes in the cattle towns, but the real housebreaking in the American West came courtesy of the government-sanctioned moves by railroad interest, mining companies, and similar operations. In a sense, they created their own Wild West. Men were drawn to mining communities by their potential for individual gain, according to historian Richard Maxwell Brown. Out of that motivation developed the hectic life cycle of the mining town. The first phase is that of the rough mining camp in the throes of a frantic boom, the change from the dismal mining camp of tents and hovels to a cosmopolitan modern city was speedy. In the transition to industrial status, the frontier strain was not altogether lost, and the mining town experience retained the bustling character of pioneer life. But at some point in time, reality arrived. You know, that character was a constant as the cattle drives made their inevitable pass north from Texas in the years after the Civil War. These were challenging flights of madness that would last 4 months of 14-hour days in a blistering sun. Arrivals at the boomtime destinations like Dodge City and Abilene in Kansas were among the most notable and quickly notorious. And they meant slaughter for the beefy herds and getting smashed for the cowboys who rode point. And for many fans of the era, the runs are the central stage on which the license meets the law and order, as sheriffs and other badge wearers had to encourage fun within the limits. The limits were only because families and civic groups coming into the city for their own more muted pleasures demanded it. So the likes of Bat Masterson, Wild Bill Hickok, Wyatt Earp tried to keep some semblance of order even as they profited themselves from all that fun. In Dodge City, there were conflicts between cowboys who came in and got paid and the lawmen who kept trying to maintain peace without driving away the business. The towns in Kansas were where the cattle came in, and like a lot of Western industries, the workforce was heavily male, and when they got done with the work, they were paid, and they would usually drink a little, gamble a little, and whatever town it happened to be at the end point would profit from all of it. But you'd have to ask yourself, how much of this could we stand? These unruly guys are antithetical to civilization and to families and schools. So to what extent were the towns going to set a tolerance on vice? One big deciding factor on that tolerance came with the evolution of the railroad. The industry that did more than anything else to both speed up the movement west and turn it into a more mature region with a profit-based approach. The completion of the first transcontinental railroad immediately impacted western travel and transportation.
Covered wagons took 4 months and stagecoach 20 days to carry their passengers and freight from the Missouri River to Oregon or California. Now you can make that trip in about 4 days in much more comfort. This notably shortened travel time in one generation seemed an amazing feat of technological achievement to Americans in the 1870s. It's also a remarkable exercise of absolute power grabbing by savvy individuals. The four big railroad industrialists, Collis Huntington, Mark Hopkins, Leland Stanford, and Charles Crocker, made a crazy profit from government land subsidies that gave them enormous leeway in their plan for the Central Pacific Railroad. Another line, the Union Pacific is run by Thomas Durant, whose financial structure plan would lead his company into unbelievable scandal. But all that will come later. First, the Chinese immigrants, who would eventually become marginalized, were brought in to work the rails with a smooth efficiency. The Native Americans watched the skies fill with clouds of fumes. The smoke was signal that the white man's prosperity was sadly right around the corner, with a plan to take more and more land to make way for progress. Tribes clashed with construction teams, but the coal-fed engine of progress would not be stopped. You know, prime example of what happened was with Dodge City. It was a town full of cowboys who just got off the trail, ready to whip it up. But once the families moved in, the middle class took over. Cowboys no longer welcome. As business enterprises, the railroads don't work out, according to Richard White, but as speculative enterprises, great fortunes were made. The convergence of individual interest with corporate money also told its harsh, necessary tale about the gold rush. Carpenter John Marshall first found the shiny ore in California as he helped build Sutter's Mill in 1848. But it would take another year for the 49ers to be fully drawn in by the idea of what could be discovered in them narrow hills. In fact, Marshall's boss, Johann Sutter, found his property completely overrun by prospectors. Millions of ounces of gold were uncovered by these individual excavators working with a pan or a pickaxe. And while they spent years quite literally scratching the surface, a sense of madness abounded. There was no adequate housing, no food, regulation, or claims. In short, it was the West at just about its wildest, with folks coming in from the East and from Europe and from every other direction. Also smelling the opportunity to make a good buck were businesses ready to cater to the prospectors. From the general store orders, the general store owners, to those referred to as the soil doves, ready to service the men in the brothels in the newly built towns. And beyond that stood the interest of the government and bigger businesses. Mining companies came in and went about placer drilling, followed by hydraulic drilling, both of which allowed them to potentially unearth the deeper pockets where a true lode might be found. And when gold and silver and other minerals were found elsewhere, more miners and companies flocked, and the same pattern happened all over again, just in a different location. That spelled more deadly consequences for the native peoples occupying land that was now too rich to not work. So it was definitely an equation that resulted in a lot of death, blood, and suffering. And on that note, we've come to the end of today's show. And of the week show. We'll be back on Monday when once again you'll be listening to Ken Hudnall and the Ken Hudnall Show. Until then, have a truly great weekend.